Brothers and sisters, we're ready to begin our third class. Our speaker is Brother Neville Clark. The theme for Brother Clark's classes this week is Revelation, Things Which Must Shortly Come to Pass. Today's class is entitled The Rainbowed Angel.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman. Good morning, my dear brethren and sisters, young people. Well, you know, we concluded our consideration yesterday morning with the timeline of Revelation chapter 14, which, of course, gave us the detail of the remainder of the sixth and the seventh vial of Revelation 16. The seventh vial particularly was a vial that commenced and concluded in war. It commenced, if you like, at the end of the sixth vial in year 10 of our chart with the Battle of Armageddon, and concludes in year 50 with the ultimate downfall of the kingdom of men of Great Babylon. Right after the Battle of Armageddon, however, there was that 10-year epoch of time where the Midheaven Proclamation was announced, the appeal to all nations to cast their crowns and to submit to the king who was now enthroned in Jerusalem, which he had taken in the Battle of Armageddon. Well, that proclamation appears to have had a measure of a success, but only a measure, because in Revelation 14 and verse 8 it tells us that Rome is destroyed. That is Babylon. Not Great Babylon, the entire system, but Babylon the city, the mother of that system. She's destroyed. And that tells you something. Why didn't the saints destroy Moscow? Why didn't the saints destroy Washington? Well, because the problem came from Rome. And the papacy, as we will be aware, would be extremely suspicious of the king that stands in Zion, branding him the Antichrist, who is going to be in direct opposition, of course, to the papacy itself. Well, the preaching continues for a further 30 years, mixed with judgment. And at the end of that subsequent 30 years, which is now year 50, we have the burial of the kingdom of men. Men blaspheme, the nations are angry, but the nations are brought to heel over that space of 50 years. And as we found, that conquest of the kingdom of men would come about in two stages. Stage one, the Battle of Armageddon, called in Revelation chapter 14, the harvest of the earth. Stage two, the destruction of Catholic Europe, called in Revelation chapter 14, the vintage of the earth. And you can see, as we explained yesterday, depending on whether you read Revelation 16, Daniel 2, Ezekiel 38, 39, Revelation 14, the various titles for those two great military campaigns, but they're all the same. Stage 1, Armageddon. Stage 2, the destruction of Babylon the Great and the cleansing of Catholic Europe. Well, we put that together across the timeline of Revelation chapter 14. And you can see at the bottom there, the harvest of the earth, verses 14 to 16 of Revelation 14, Armageddon. The vintage of the earth, verses 17 to 20 of Revelation 14, the conquest of Europe, judgment upon Catholic Europe. And we explain that as being the 30-year period, the 1 hour with the beast. Revelation 14, I think verse 8 spoke about, or verse 7, the Midheaven Proclamation warned of the 1 hour of judgment to come, which we explained was a 30-year period of time. So, no mystery, that was everything we discovered yesterday in Revelation chapter 14. But here's the interesting thing, if I take you back there, that's the seventh vial. That 40-year period from year 10 to year 50 is the seventh vial of Revelation chapter 16. But the story of the judgments of the book of Revelation doesn't conclude with the seventh vial, because the seventh vial merely opens the seven thunders of Revelation chapter 10, as we see here. Well, then the question is, when do the seven thunders get announced? And the answer to that is, that's the 30 years. That's the judgment of the 30 years. The seven thunders will usher their existence upon Europe, bringing in the ultimate downfall of the papal system and everything associated with it. There's the story of the 50-year Jubilee period, the detail of Revelation 14, and of course, that brings us now to Revelation chapter 10. If you read with me, Revelation chapter 10, verse 1, we read the following. I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud and a rainbow upon his head. His face was, as it were, the sun, his feet as pillars of fire. He had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot upon the earth. And he cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. This is the chapter in Revelation commonly called the March of the Rainbowed Angel. It's a little bit of a misnomer, actually, because the angel is not marching in verse 1. He's standing. He has completed his conquest. So the opening verses of this chapter, if I had to put a date on them, I'd be saying year 50, verses 1 and 2. The angel has completed his conquest. He's got one foot on the sea, one foot on the land, which I'll explain by and by. But he's standing. He's finished. And he has announced seven thunders. And those seven thunders have brought about the complete demise of the kingdom of men. This is what Brother Thomas says of those seven thunders, of this little book or little scroll in verse 2. This little scroll is the most important fragment of the apocalypse because it contains the catastrophe of the plot. He says this is the most important section of the entire book of Revelation. It's the conclusion, without which all the rest of Revelation will be of little interest to the believer. By the angel holding that little scroll in his hand, his power is identified with the execution of its contents, and the character of these is indicated by his voice. These thunders are the lightnings and voices and thunderings and earthquake and great hail of Revelation 11 verse 19. That is, the judgments of the seventh vial, which exhaust the wrath of deity and give victory to the saints and rest for 1,000 years. So what he's simply saying is that when these seven thunders utter their voice across that 30-year epoch of judgment, it will bring the demise of the beast and herald the commencement of the millennial reign of Christ, just as our timeline showed a moment ago. But do you know the irony of these words, of the words of this scroll? The irony is this, verse 4, we don't even know what they say. It's the catastrophe of the plot, but it's hidden to us. Verse 4 of Revelation 10, and when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, John says, I was about to, when I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, stop, seal up those things which the seven thunders have uttered, and write them not. Don't write them, John. So he was about to write them, and he's told to stop. He knows what they said. He knows what they did. We don't. And he wasn't allowed to tell us. Verse 8 of Revelation 10 goes on and tells John what he was to do with that information. The voice which I heard from heaven then spake again to me and said, John, go and take that little scroll which is open in the hand of the angel which stands on the sea and upon the earth, that is the angel of verse 1. So I went to the angel and I said to him, give me the little book. And he said to me, take it and eat it up. It shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand, and I did eat it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey. And as soon as I'd eaten it, my belly was bitter, he says. So there you are. He saw the seven thunders uttered. He saw the devastation of those thunders. He saw what they did and how they did it. And he sealed it up. He ate it. He disposed of the evidence. Now that's interesting, you know, because way back in Revelation chapter 5, you might remember, there was a scroll with seven seals. And no man in heaven or earth was able to open that scroll and loose the seals thereof, it tells us in Revelation 5 verse 1. Even a strong angel couldn't do it. So the slain lamb, had to do it. And the point is that John wept because nobody could open that scroll. Well, the tables are turned here, aren't they? John's given a prophecy himself. He reads it, then he closes it, and none of us can open it. So, of course, I can't tell you just precisely what those seven thunders were, because I don't know any more than you do. But we know what they're going to accomplish. and we know something about how they're going to accomplish it. And so we can put a lot of colour into this picture, even if we can't define the precise detail. Now, before we begin to explain Revelation chapter 10, let me just show you something about where Revelation 10 is placed in the entire record of the book of Revelation. Come back with me to chapter 9, verse 1. You know, we've got seals, trumpets, vials, thunders. Revelation 9, verse 1 is the trumpet section. And in 9, verse 1, it tells us that the fifth angel sounded, that is, the fifth trumpet blew. And in verse 13 of Revelation 9, it says, the sixth angel sounded his voice. So this is the sixth trumpet blowing. And when you come across to chapter 11 and verse 15, it says, and the seventh angel sounded, great voices in heaven. There's the seventh trumpet. And of course, the seventh trumpet brings in the seven vials, the seventh of which brings in the seven thunders. So no mystery there. But here's the problem. When does the sixth trumpet begin? Well, it begins in Revelation 9, verse 13. Where does the sixth trumpet end? Well, it ends, evidently, in Revelation 11, verse 14, because the seventh trumpet begins in Revelation 11, verse 15. And so what do you make of Revelation 10? It's inserted in the midst of the sixth trumpet. Do you see that? The sixth trumpet is chapter 9, verse 13 to 21, and continues in chapter 11, verses 1 to 14. And in the midst of that, bisecting the sixth trumpet, we have Revelation chapter 10. And it's no mistake that it's inserted here, by the way, because Revelation 10 verse 7 says that in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God shall be finished. Well, the seventh angel that's mentioned in Revelation 10 verse 7 is the seventh angel of Revelation 11 verse 15. So what John's saying here is that the seven thunders that he's describing in Revelation chapter 10 will be played out in the seventh angel trumpet of Revelation 15. Now, the seventh angel trumpet contains the seven vials. The seventh vial contains the seven thunders. So that's when it'll happen. The point is, Revelation 10 is going to happen after Revelation 11 verse 15. Then why is it placed right here? Why are we given the vision of Revelation 10 in the midst of the sixth trumpet of Revelation chapters 9 and 11? Well, the answer is in one verse, and it's in Revelation 11 and verse 7. Because it says in Revelation 11 verse 7, and when they shall have, the witnesses have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them. This is the first mention in the book of Revelation of the beast. The beasts that we have already spoken about in Revelation 12, 13, 17, the seven-headed, ten-horned beast, that doesn't begin to chapter 12. This is the first time the word beast, that beast, appears in Revelation. And that's the problem. Because what are the trumpets of Revelation 9 and Revelation 11 speaking about? Well, Revelation 9 verse 1, the fifth trumpet is the rise of the Saracen Empire from Saudi Arabia, which judged the Eastern Roman Empire, went to war. The sixth trumpet in Revelation 9 and verse 13 is the rise of the Ottoman Empire that took Constantinople, went to war against the Eastern Roman Empire. And whilst that was happening in the East, Revelation 11, verses 1 to 14, tells us what's happening in the West, in Western Europe. And there was persecution by the beast in Western Europe. And you see, Revelation chapter 10 is the visions for the brothers and sisters who died for their faith in Western Europe while the Muslims were campaigning against the Roman Empire in the East. It's because of the beast in Revelation chapter 11 and verse 7 that we have the visions of Revelation 10 placed where they are amidst the sixth trumpet. Well, that's the context of Revelation 10 in the book of Revelation. Let me show you something about the context of Revelation 10 in the entire Bible. You come back with me to Ezekiel chapter 1. There is a remarkable parallel between Ezekiel's vision in chapters 1, 2, and 3 and the rainbowed angel, so-called, described in Revelation chapter 10. It says in Ezekiel 1, in verse 4, "I looked and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north," Ezekiel says, "a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself, and brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the colour of amber out of the midst of the fire." So he sees a great cloud come out of the north. Well, John sees an angel clothed with a cloud in Revelation 10, verse 1. If you come across to Ezekiel 1 and verse 27, it tells us that Ezekiel saw as the colour of amber, the appearance of fire round about within it. From the appearance of his loins, upward and downward, they were of fire. Well, in Revelation 10, verse 1, John sees this angel has legs like pillars of fire. Verse 28, "And as the appearance of a bow that's in the cloud of rain, so is the appearance of the brightness round about." This cherubic figure in Ezekiel 1 is surrounded by a rainbow, just as the angel is in Revelation 10, verse 1. And look at this in Ezekiel 2, verse 9. "And when I looked," Ezekiel says, "behold, a hand was sent unto me, and lo, a roll of a book was therein." So in his hand was a little scroll, Revelation 10, verse 2. "And he spread it before me," verse 10 of Ezekiel 2, "and in it was written within and without, and there was written lamentations, mourning, and woe." Now that's interesting, because the thunders of Revelation chapter 10, rather, a part of the seventh woe trumpet of Revelation 11 and verse 14. Well, chapter 3, verse 1, "Moreover, he said to me, Son of man, eat that thou findest. Eat this roll and go and speak to the house of Israel." Ezekiel's told to eat the scroll. The scroll in the hand of the man. Eat the scroll. Well, precisely, Revelation 10, verse 9. "And so he ate it," verse 3. "He said to me, Son of man, cause thy belly to eat. Fill thy bowels with this roll that I give thee. Then I did eat it. It was in my mouth as honey for sweetness." Well, look at that. That's exactly Revelation 10, verse 10. And in verse 14 of Ezekiel 3, it tells us that the Spirit lifted Ezekiel up and it took him away, and he went in bitterness, it says, just as though this scroll was bitter in John's belly. Now, Ezekiel was bitter because though the message was sweet, the nation wouldn't hear him. So it was a bitter message to deliver. Very much the same for John. The thunders that he was going to deliver would be bitter because it would cause much loss of life, even though the result would be sweet, ultimately. Ezekiel is sent, what's more, in verse 15, to those in the captivity. He's sent to his countrymen. John is sent, in Revelation 10, verse 11, to peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. And in verse 7 of Ezekiel chapter 3, his people wouldn't listen to him. And in Revelation 11, verse 18, the nation would blaspheme and be angry when the thunders were sounded. So there's the story of Revelation chapter 10 in the context of the book of Revelation, and the story of Revelation chapter 10 in the context of the Bible. Can you see that? That Revelation 10 is based fairly and squarely upon the vision to Ezekiel in Ezekiel chapters 1, 2, and 3. And this vision in Ezekiel, of course, is the start of a great story in Ezekiel, because this cherubic story that you read of in these chapters is about a man on a cherubic vehicle who comes in and removes the glory of God from the temple in Jerusalem and takes it out by the way of the east in order that the Babylonians might come in and destroy the temple. God left Jerusalem in order that it might be destroyed by Babylon, which it duly was. Well, now come with me to Revelation 10. What does it all mean? Well, it's a remarkable story. Revelation chapter 10 and verse 1. Every detail that you read in these verses is significant. Revelation 10, verse 1, "I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud. A rainbow was upon his head. His face was, as it were, the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire." Another mighty angel. The point here is that this is not one of the trumpet angels of Revelation chapter 9. This is a mighty angel, like the angel in Revelation chapter 5. He came down from heaven. 2 Peter 3 verse 13 describes the kingdom age as a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. In the language of the prophets, therefore, heaven is a symbol for government. So this angel comes from government, from after Christ has conquered Jerusalem. It's a vision that happens after the Battle of Armageddon, because Christ and the saints are in heaven. They are in government at this moment of time, clothed with a cloud. Hebrews 12 verse 1 speaks of the saints being a great cloud of witnesses. Revelation 1 verse 7, Christ cometh with clouds and every eye shall see him. So the clouds are not literal clouds. If they were literal clouds, no eye could see him. But this is a great crowd of people, as it were, clothing the angel of the bow of verse 1. Now that's most interesting, you know, because we'll just pause and consider that for a moment. When we're baptized, we read in places like Galatians 3 verse 27 that we put on Christ. We clothe ourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ in a garment of white, speaking of forgiveness. Here in Revelation 10 verse 1, Christ clothes himself with us. Now, of course, there's something very powerful and very humbling about that, isn't there? It really does make you pause and consider what state your wedding garment's in, because this is what we're called to. In Ezekiel 1, Christ is enthroned upon the cherubic chariot of the saints. In Revelation 10, he's clothed with the saints. It's the same point, just different figures, slightly different figures. And he's got a rainbow over his head. In Genesis 9, verse 16, the rainbow was a covenant that God made that he would never again destroy the earth. Instead, as we read in Revelation 11 and verse 18, he will destroy them that do destroy the earth, or corrupt the earth, as it means. His face was as the sun, a symbol of immortality, because the righteous shall shine forth as the sun. Matthew 13, 43. His feet were like fire. Your marginal reference will take you against that point back to Revelation chapter 1. In verse 15, speaking of the multitudinous Christ of Revelation 1, and there are many similarities. But here, fire, of course, is a symbol of judgment. 2 Thessalonians 1, verse 8, Christ will come in flaming fire to take vengeance on them that know not and obey not the gospel. So here is Christ and the saints in a militant manifestation, destroying them that destroy the earth, charged with fire of judgment, having completed their judgment process, standing on the sea and on the earth, it says in verse 2. The sea and the earth. Well, if you just flip across two pages, you'll see in Revelation 13, verse 1, that there rose out of the sea a beast, the beast of the sea. In Revelation 13, verse 11, I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, the beast of the earth. So, he now dominates the area of the old beast of the sea and the beast of the earth. This is Western Europe. And if you would, in the language of Ephesians 1, verse 22, he's put all things under his feet. He has conquered the entire system. So this is the resolution of the plot. Year 50, after the demise of the kingdom of men and the victory of the rainbowed angel. But verse 2 says that he had in his hand a little book open. And this book is most interesting. There are three words for book in the New Testament. That is three Greek words. The word biblos, the word biblion, and the word bibliaridion. Each one a diminutive of the previous. The word biblos is the common word for book. It's used for books of the Bible, Matthew 1 verse 1. This is the book of the generations of Jesus Christ. It just means book. It's used of the book of life. And so that book, the big book, if you like, the biblos, would represent 6,000 years of man's history to the kingdom age. It's all the books of the Bible. It's the complete epoch of man's history. Biblion. Revelation 5 verse 1, that's the word biblion. It's a little scroll. It's not a big book, it's a little book or a little scroll. In Revelation 5, verse 1, the seven-sealed scroll that was unwound was 2,000 years of history until the kingdom age. But the book here in verse 2 is a Bibliaridion, an even smaller book, a tiny book. Only appears in Revelation chapter 10, that word, and it represents just the period of the seventh vial, just the 40 years of the seventh vial, the remaining 30 of which would be the judgment of the seven thunders. So big book, medium-sized book, little book, if you like, and this is the little book. So it's only a very small book because it only represents a very small epoch of time. And he cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth, and when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices, it says. Now there's a clue there. The lion roars. Who's the lion of Revelation? Well, it's easy. It's the Lord Jesus Christ. Revelation 5, verse 5, he's the lion of the tribe of Judah. What does it mean when the lion roars? Well, in Joel 3, verse 16, Yahweh roared from Zion, and the battle of Armageddon was commenced. In Isaiah 42, verse 13, Yahweh shall go forth as a mighty man. He'll stir up jealousy like a man of war. He shall cry, yea, roar. He shall prevail against his enemies. So the lion roared when the thunders started to get uttered, when the 30-year period of judgment upon Europe began. That's when the lion roared. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, John was about to write them, but was told not to. Well, that's the timing of the seven thunders of Revelation chapter 10. The thunder judgments come after the Battle of Armageddon, 10 years we're saying, after Armageddon, and are uttered for the following 30 years until year 50. So what exactly are the thunders? What would you make of those thunders? Well, of course, as I've said, I can't precisely tell you. But I think I can imprecisely tell you. Come with me to Psalm 29. We've got a remarkable psalm here that helps us, I believe, identify something of the character of these seven thunders of Revelation chapter 10. Psalm 29, well, Psalm 29 is an interesting psalm. It breaks into three sections. It's a psalm all about a storm. Verses 1 and 2 are a call to worship. Verses 3 through 9 are a description of the storm. And verses 10 and 11 are a blessing of peace. It's only a little short psalm. A call to worship, the introduction. The story of the psalm, the storm, verses 3 to 9, and the conclusion, a blessing, verses 10 to 11. So what's the story? Well, this is a great storm that comes in from the Mediterranean Sea and runs down the length of the land of Israel and blows itself out in the south. And you can tell that because look at verse 3. The voice of Yahweh is upon the waters. The God of glory thundereth. Yahweh is upon many waters. So there's the Mediterranean Sea, the many waters, as this storm begins. Verse 5. The voice of Yahweh breaketh the cedars. Yea, Yahweh breaketh the cedars of Lebanon. So now the storms come inland to Lebanon, and the cedars are splitting and falling to the ground as the storm ruptures the trees of those forests. Verse 6. He maketh them also to skip like a calf, Lebanon and Syrian, like a young unicorn. Now Syrian, it tells us in Deuteronomy 3 verse 9, is Mount Hermon. So we've now migrated from Lebanon in the north down a little further south to Hermon, and the storm is still raging until verse 8 tells us that the voice of Yahweh shaketh the wilderness. Yahweh shaketh the wilderness of Kadesh. Well, this is Kadesh Barnea. This is now in the south, and the storm exhausts itself in the south. And it tells us in the very last line of the last verse that Yahweh will bless his people with peace. Oh. And you might look at this and say, in a literal sense, well, this is the story of every storm, isn't it? The rage of the tempest, the fury of the elements, the destruction of everything in its path, so that by contrast, when the storm is over, the whole land is at peace. But this is not the peace of the storm that's been spoken about at the conclusion of the psalm. This is peace with God, isn't it? I mean, look at verse 10. Yahweh sitteth upon the flood. Yahweh sitteth king forever. Yahweh will give strength to his people. Yahweh will bless his people with peace. That's not talking about fixing the storm or blowing out the storm. This is peace with God, and Yahweh is king forever in verse 10. So whatever the storm means, it accomplishes the fact that God is king and his people have peace with him. Now look closely at the psalm. Look at verse 1. Give unto Yahweh, O ye mighty, give unto Yahweh glory and strength. Give unto Yahweh the glory due to his name. Worship Yahweh in the beauty of holiness. That's a call to service. That's a call to submit your strength to God and to worship him. And that's interesting. Let me read you by way of recall. Revelation 14, verse 7, the mid-heaven proclamation. Fear God, give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him that made heaven and earth, the sea and the fountains of water. Do you see a parallel? The opening verses, verses 1 and 2 of this psalm, are a call for the world to submit to God. Well, whatever the world's response to that was, a great storm then plays out. The consequence of which is when the storm's finished, Yahweh is king and his people are at peace. It's not really about a storm, is it? It's not really about a storm at all. And what's more, this storm has a name. Verse 3, the voice of Yahweh. Verse 4, the voice of Yahweh. Verse 4, the voice of Yahweh. Verse 5, the voice of Yahweh. Verse 7, the voice of Yahweh. Verse 8, the voice of Yahweh. Verse 9, the voice of Yahweh. How many times did I say the voice of Yahweh? 7 times. And what do you know about the voice of Yahweh in this psalm? Look at verse 3. The voice of Yahweh is upon the waters, the God of glory thundereth. There are 7 thunders in Psalm 29. And those 7 thunders are uttered by that voice after an appeal to give glory to God, resulting in Yahweh being king and his people being at peace. I think that's not a bad template for Revelation chapter 10, don't you? For Revelation chapter 14, that is precisely the sequence of events that happens in the seventh vial. And the 7 thunders make that happen. Isn't that interesting? So what would you make of it? All right, it's a bit of a template. It's a parallel. Well, it would appear that when God utters his voice, the natural elements are brought into play to judge the world. And a great storm comes upon the world, resulting in the world coming to heel. Now that's interesting. Come with me to Revelation 16. The last verse of Revelation 16, that is Revelation 16 and verse 21, says this. You understand, Revelation 16, verses 17 to 21, is the seventh vial. It's the same period of time as these 7 thunders are poured out in. And in verse 21 of Revelation 16, it says that there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven. Every stone about the weight of a talent, that's about 30 kilograms, 60 pounds. Men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof was exceeding great. Now it's interesting. Because in Ezekiel 38, verse 22, the natural elements are used against Gog. I will plead with Gog with pestilence, blood, rain, fire, brimstone, and hailstones. Now, this is not talking about Armageddon in verse 21 of Revelation 16. Armageddon's back in verse 16. This is stage 2 destruction. This is the destruction upon Europe. What's the bet? The natural elements are brought into being in stage 2 of God's military campaign in precisely the same way they are in stage 1. And that the 7 thunders are a utilization of the natural elements against man that destroys the kingdom of men. Oh yes, it'll be done at the hand of the saints. Miraculous, no doubt, but a manipulation of the natural elements in any case. I would draw your attention to the fact, just as you cast your eye across Revelation 16, we've got hail in verse 21. We've got sores or boils in verse 2. We've got blood in verse 4. We've got darkness in verse 10. We've got frogs in verse 13. Remarkably reminiscent of the plagues of Egypt. And when the entire beast system is destroyed, the vision of Revelation chapter 15 and verse 3 says that they sing the song of Moses, which Moses sang after the conclusion of the 10 plagues of Egypt and the destruction of Pharaoh's host. And I would observe further that whilst there were certainly 10 plagues in Egypt, only 3 of them affected Israel. The final 7 were for the Egyptians only. There were 7 plagues of Egypt, if I could say it in those terms. Remarkable. Now let me show you something else. Revelation 10, come back to Revelation 10, we're up to verse 5. Revelation 10, verse 5. The angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven and swear by him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven and the things that therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things that are therein, that there should be time no longer. Now that's an interesting phrase. It says time no longer. It means delay no longer. The action's going to come now. It's now time to judge the world. But that's an echo. At the end of Revelation 10 verse 6, that's an echo from somewhere else in the book of Revelation. Where am I thinking of? Time no longer. Come with me to Revelation 6. Just a page back, Revelation 6, verse 9. When he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. So these are brothers and sisters who have been killed by the apostate system, be it pagan Roman, Christian Roman, it doesn't matter. They've been killed for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, "How long? How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? How long do we have to wait?" And that cry comes from those who are under the altar, slain by the beast system for the things they believed, and they cry for vengeance against that system, or vengeance comes in Revelation chapter 10. But here's the thing. How does vengeance come? How does it come? Well, of course, it comes by the 7 thunders of Revelation chapter 10, which judge that system and destroy Great Babylon. It comes, as it were, when the vintage of the earth is trodden in the winepress of the wrath of God, in the language of Revelation chapter 14. But let me show you how that's described in Revelation 14. Come with me to Revelation 14, verse 17. This, of course, is the second appendix of Revelation 14, verses 17 to 20, is stage 2 of the military campaign. So we're on solid ground here. This is the judgment upon Europe. Another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven. You remember we made the point yesterday that verse 15, the angel that brought about Armageddon came from the temple. After Armageddon, once Christ is enthroned in Zion and is in government, the angel in verse 17 comes from the temple in heaven, the ecclesia in government. And he's also got a sharp sickle, just like the Armageddon angel did in verse 15. The European, let's call it, the European angel of verse 17 also has a sharp sickle. But look at verse 18. And another angel came out from the altar, which had power over fire, and cried with a loud voice to him that had the sharp sickle, that is the angel of verse 17, saying, "Thrust in thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine on the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe." What does that mean? It's overdue. There can be time no longer. Do you see the point? The harvesting angel of verse 17 harvested Europe at the instruction of the angel from under the altar of verse 18. It was in response to the saints under the altar who for all of those years, across many decades of this apostate system, have lost their lives for the things they witnessed. It was their instruction that brought destruction upon the European beast. I mean, there's poetry there. But let me show you something else. Come into Revelation 10. Revelation 10, John wasn't allowed to tell us what the real content of those thunders was. Instead, rather than write the book down, he's got to eat the book. He's got to make the message part of himself. The message has got to go with him. Why? Why? Verse 10 of Revelation 10. I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it up. It was in my mouth, sweet as honey. And as soon as I'd eaten it, it was in my belly, bitter. And he said to me, John, thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. So why was John told to eat it? Because the message has to live with him, and it will be his time to reveal it in the future, before peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. But that's very significant. Because you come with me to Revelation 14 and verse 6. I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven. So this is the mid-heaven proclamation of Revelation 14 verses 6 and 7. I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to them that dwell on the earth and to every, look at it, nation and kindred and tongue and people. So there's a remarkable parallel between Revelation 14 verse 6 and Revelation 10 verse 11. What would you make of that? What would you make of that, brothers and sisters? Well, I'll tell you what I make of it. I think the Apostle John's going to lead the mid-heaven proclamation. I think he's the one that's going to lead the charge against the Roman system that imprisoned him on Patmos. The system that killed his brethren of the first century and all subsequent centuries. And he'll beg them to repent, and they'll spit at him. They'll be angry. They'll blaspheme his God. And as Moses held out his staff across the Red Sea, he'll bring the hammer down and the thunders will begin to sound one after the other, all seven upon that system until finally it's destroyed. The thunders, the mystery of the thunders rests with John. And in his due time, when there shall be time no longer, it will be his job to conduct the campaign that yields him upon the world. And where will it end? Well, of course, it ends with the destruction of the beast system, doesn't it? Great Babylon will be conquered, her smoke will ascend up to heaven, and all the earth will have rest, and the millennial 1,000 years will commence in year 50, as it were, of our timeline. And then, when that 50 years is completed, the prophecy of Ezekiel will come back to life. Because you remember, Ezekiel saw this cherubim, the cherubic vehicle, inhabited by a man upon a throne, the glory of the God of Israel. And in Ezekiel chapter 8, 9, 10, it tells us explicitly that that cherubim removed the glory of God from the most holy place in the temple in Jerusalem and took it out by the way of the east, and it disappeared into the desert. But in Ezekiel chapter 43, the glory returns from the east. And the glory then inhabits the most holy place, and then the glory fills the house in Ezekiel 44 and verse 4. What's the message there? The cherubim of Ezekiel, one that removed the glory, will bring it back. And that cherubim is nothing more than the saints, than Christ clothed with the saints. And the Lord Jesus Christ will enter in through the east gate and inhabit the temple in year 50 after the false religious system of the world has been destroyed, and bathe the world in religious truth, and so will it exist for the next 1,000 years. And so all the world will have peace. And true religion will be the herald of the day.